most every Buddhist teacher of my generation got started with psychedelics. You name them, and I'll tell you, they were tripping. But there was something more important. We were looking for something. And we live in a culture that's almost defined at sometimes by the absence of the sacred. And yet we feel that this kind of yearning, this intuitive wish to connect, whether it's going high in the mountains or making love or taking psychedelics or meditating. And I was drawn, yes, I was in Haight-Ashbury in the 60s and took my share of acid. But I was drawn to go to a Buddhist monastery because I wanted to understand, and I could feel from the psychedelics, as many of the founding teachers of current Buddhist, Western Buddhist community, that there was something mysterious and really important.
You can't separate psychedelics from life, says Jack Kornfield. Psychedelics in nature open you up to wonder and curiosity, says Louis Schwartzberg. This is Heart Wisdom, Jack Kornfield's podcast on the Be Here Now Network. I'm Ganesh, Jack's assistant, welcoming you to episode 235, From Psychedelics to Mindfulness. Louis Schwartzberg is today's guest. He is a director. You may know the movie Fantastic Fungi, which he is best known for, and any of the Moving Art series. His time-lapse style cinematography truly opens those up who watch it to a sacred experience. He describes what he shares as patterns that the soul can connect to. And that is true for what he shares verbally here in this podcast alongside Jack as well. So as you probably guessed it, this episode, this conversation, is all about the connection between psychedelics and spirituality. Jack and Louis vulnerably share their psychedelic experiences and insights and how that has affected and aided them along the spiritual path. Louis explores how psychedelics affected his filmmaking. Jack talks about exchanging roadmaps with the famous LSD researcher Stanislav Grof, who when Jack first met was married to Roshi Joan Halifax, who you probably know pretty well if you've been following the Be Here Now Network or Ram Dass. And as they explore psychedelics as a gateway to wonder, curiosity, and the sacred, the timing in my life could not be more impeccable, as I just returned from a music festival in Texas, where some of the leaders in psychedelic science, like Rick Doblin, Paul Stamets, Bruce Damer, all shared about the wonderful benefits that psychedelics can give us and the new psychedelic renaissance which they are heading up. The cherry on top was actually seeing Rick Doblin, who is helping MDMA be legalized for therapeutic use, dancing around to a hybrid funk and electronic act while wearing an astronaut suit for the eclipse. And for those of us less psychedelically intrigued, you may be saying, "Whoa, I thought Jack was a Buddhist teacher. I thought there was a precept about intoxicants." Well, Jack actually dives into that in this episode, sharing what the precept is actually for. In this episode, like many of the others we've been putting out recently, actually has a video counterpart. So if you'd like to watch Jack's flower sermon, which he actually gives in this episode, you can head to jackkornfield.com or BeHereNowNetwork.com in order to watch the video of this conversation. So before diving in to this wonderful conversation on set and setting, integration, and all good things psychedelic and spiritual, I have to give a shout out to Banyan Together, who actually filmed this talk. Banyan Together, formerly Cloud Sangha, is Jack and Tara Brock's brainchild for creating digital spiritual community. They hold online groups in various topics for you to be able to share your experiences in life and spirituality and whatever truly interests and sparks you in the realm of consciousness and compassion. You can head to BanyanTogether.com in order to dive into all of their offerings. And we thank Banyan so much for allowing us to use this amazing talk here on the Heart Wisdom Podcast. So as always, thank you for joining us. It is my honor to present to you Heart Wisdom Episode 235, From Psychedelics to Mindfulness with Louis Schwartzberg and Jack Kornfield. May life show you how good it can get. May you be presented with wonder, curiosity, and the sacred. May you help others through the authenticity of your own being. And may your heart be smiling. Namaste.
Hi, Louis. I'm so happy we get to have this conversation. And I'll just say a couple of things and ask you a question. We both, as many people listening, have a history with psychedelics. And mine started back in the 60s, back in the day. And most every Buddhist teacher of my generation got started with psychedelics. You name them, and I'll tell you, they were tripping. But there was something more important. We were looking for something. And we live in a culture that's almost defined it sometimes by the absence of the sacred. And yet we feel that this kind of yearning, this intuitive wish to connect, whether it's going high in the mountains or making love or taking psychedelics or meditating. And I was drawn, yes, I was in Haight-Ashbury in the 60s and took my share of acid. But I was drawn to go to a Buddhist monastery because I wanted to understand, and I could feel from the psychedelics, as many of the founding teachers of current Buddhist, Western Buddhist community, that there was something mysterious and really important. And so I went off to find it and did in all kinds of ways, written about, talked about. But one of the great things that I discovered, which Willem mentioned and Louis speaks to so much, is that you can't separate psychedelics from life. And it's one thing to do a trip and say, okay, I had an experience. It's like going to, you know, the theme park. I went to Disneyland. I had a great ride. But it's another to sense that these are actually a gateway to a shift of consciousness that sees the sacred and the beauty around us. And then they can be complements. They can serve one another in mysterious and amazing ways. So I'll spoke a little, and let's see what Louis wants to dive into.
Well, thank you, Jack. And I'd love and admire everything that you do. It's been a joy to work with you as well. Yeah, I also got turned on in the late 60s and early 70s at UCLA. I was a poli-sci history major. I started to get into photography by documenting the anti-war protests and the police brutality that was happening on campus. How could I study the French Revolution when there was one happening literally outside my door? And that turned me on to photography. Photography was a way to become a little more present because I could look at rhythms and patterns that I had never seen before. And then I hitchhiked, which was another experience of total freedom, up the coast during a spring break, ended up on the border between California and Oregon. And that's when I took my first psychedelic trip. And there was forest, ocean, even a giant sand dune. And I couldn't put it all in a lens. My lens wasn't wide enough to capture it. But I do remember having the most incredible revelation, which is that everything is energy. And I'd never read about that. I never thought about that. I just saw it. I experienced it. Everything was energy. And then that night, as I built a fire, you know, to keep myself warm, just, you know, camping out there, I saw that even the wood, the dead wood that I had found and created a fire for warmth, was a transformation of energy. You know, the wood was burning and getting heat energy off of it. And that life is life is change, and energy is change. And I think that experience shifted my whole perspective. And once you have that, you can never come back. And it certainly has influenced on my filmmaking, because then I got I started to experiment with time-lapse to bend time, micro, macro cinematography to look at things that the human eye can't see. A lot of the work I do, I think, is to make the invisible visible. And that's the perfect description of what a psychedelic journey is like, making the invisible visible. Being we're surrounded by so much energy we don't see, you know? As someone that's into photography, you know, we look at the visible light spectrum. I'm aware of that. But infrared, X-ray, gamma ray, you know, science has all this, these other wavelengths of energy we don't see, yet they're part of our universe. And so I love being able to expand our horizons and our perceptions, which is the same thing that, you know, I think mindfulness practices do, is to be able to open up from that narrow perception we see every day.
You know, you're describing your kind of awakening in there in the sand dunes on the border of Oregon and California and so forth. It's interesting. A lot of times we think of spiritual practice as kind of a path that if we're good and we practice mindfulness and compassion and patience and tolerance and dedication and so forth, we'll get to some goal somewhere. It becomes kind of a path. But actually, it's the reverse. We're not going from here to there. We're going from there to here. And in that regard, psychedelics in some way open us to a revelation you talked about. And it happened for me, in which I saw the world. It was not only energy, that's one language for it, a beautiful language. A language of the sacred was another. Another is that sometimes you can see it's made of light. Energy in a certain way is light. I believe our friend Albert had some little equation about that.
Yes.
To be able to see the world luminous, like we were doing that breath practice, to feel that you're being breathed by the earth with all beings, all of this is this beautiful kind of remembering of who you are. And a Korean, great Korean Zen master, Sue Neill, he kind of flipped the script of development to have some enlightenment. And his teaching was sudden enlightenment, then gradual practice, mm-hmm. which is really what our lives are, yours and mine, Louis, and many of you listening. There are openings that come from psychedelics and visions and so forth. And then, as Willem talked about too, the game is, how do I live this? How do I embody? How do I keep that? Which is part of what your work as an artist and cinematographer and all of that is about.
Yeah, well, I think a good friend of ours, you know, Albert Einstein, as you mentioned, you know, I think they asked him his definition of God, and he said it was a sense of wonder. And if you don't feel that and your eyes are closed, you might as well be dead. So I think that psychedelics and nature open you up to wonder and curiosity. You know, for me, that's the intersection between art and science. And it's where it makes you present. Because in that moment, staring at a flower, and as you know, it wasn't... Didn't the Buddha tell his disciples that if you want to learn everything there is to know, stare at a flower, you know?
And it's pretty close. He picked a flower and somebody got enlightened as he held the flower up in his hand. One of his great disciples saw the flower and that was it.
Yeah.
And he saw it deeply. Exactly. So all your flowers, you're really enlightening people. Everybody's they're sitting in the movie theater with their popcorn. And then this bud comes on and all of a sudden this enormous flower opens and they say, that's us. That's me. Yeah. That's this world.
Yeah. And the beautiful part about that is that wonder and curiosity, you know, seduces you with beauty to be able to watch the flower do a dance. You know, they're doing that dance all the time, but we don't see it because we live in a different time frame. But what it does is it hopefully encourages you to lean in to looking at things more deeply, to be able to not just walk by the flower and be superficial about its beauty and what it does. If you really look at the flower, oh my God, look at that pattern. It's seducing the pollinators with like color and pattern and aroma to enable it to reproduce. And because it does that, we get all the fruits, nuts, vegetables, and healthy food we need to eat. There is a deeper story happening that is the foundation of life on our planet. And yet we can be superficial and just walk by it and go, oh, it's just a flower, something I'm going to give my loved one when I mess up on Valentine's Day. It's way bigger than that, you know? And I feel that what we're doing is to turn people on, you know? And beauty isn't anything we have to go to school to learn. We're hardwired to feel it. It's in our DNA because it influences reproduction. It influences survival. We appreciate things and we're connected to things because of these wavelengths of energy. As you said, light energy is what you saw on your first trip. Well, light energy is the source of all energy on our planet. And to be able to be aware and navigate that and to understand it, again, is just another beautiful metaphor to be more open-minded. How many people on a psychedelic trip have stared at a flower or a blade of grass for an hour? And then one last thing, Jack, I want to share with you too, is like you talked about my flowers. If you ask someone to meditate and stare at that rose bud, it might take 3 days for it to open. But you have to keep looking at it. Don't go to the bathroom. Don't eat. I can show you what that experience is like with my time-lapse camera. I can show you in 10 seconds what 3 days going by, what that flower is actually doing as it dances and responds to light energy. So I'm giving, I think, people a window into a portal of time and scale that hopefully can open your consciousness.
Beautiful. You're also talking about what Suzuki Roshi called beginner's mind, you know, because when a child sees the I remember when my daughter was, you know, 18 months old or 2 years, and I was holding her, and she was learning language. And I'd go around and I'd say, well, this is a rose bush. I'd sort of give it a name and I'd introduce, say hello to the rose bush. It's like Zen Master Suzuki Roshi's beginner's mind was really saying, we can live, as you said, with a sense of wonder and freshness. The poet says, the earth laughs in flowers, that there's something about life, the beauty you talk about, manifesting that way. So I work together and have, or been a collaborator for almost 50 years with Stan Grof. Mm-hmm. And I met him in the early 70s when I came back from Buddhist monastery, and he was the last psychedelic researcher as a physician at Johns Hopkins before the laws were changed. And he had this amazing project. He was married at that time to Joan Halifax. And one of the things that was really helpful, we did two things together that was really helpful. The first is that we exchanged maps, because the Buddhist psychology and Buddhist teachings have beautiful maps of consciousness, different states of samadhi and jhana and luminosity, maps of the difficulties, the hindrances you go through, the ways to overcome those obstacles to inner freedom and compassion. And then he showed the map. He wrote about it. He said, after giving 5,000 people high-dose LSD, this is what we found. And the maps included, first, the change of perception, where everything starts to melt and dissolve, the energetic change, and you go, whoa, it's not solid. It is this dance of energy. And then there's the inner map, that when that layer sometimes opens up, you and your body dissolves and so forth. You go into history and you have a personal layer, you have deep memories and traumas and exquisite things of your past, and they all get revealed in psychedelics. And then if you get quiet and deeper, sometimes you go to the perinatal level where you relive your birth in psychedelics. Pretty common, being in the womb, getting born. And then you can feel in a deeper layer, the transpersonal or spiritual dimension, where you feel everything being born, or you become the redwood tree and the salmon and all of those things. And once I had the maps from the Buddhist side and the psychedelic side, so I could sort of, okay, how do I wander here? How can I use these to understand and stay centered? Then we put them together. And people would do his holotropic breath work, which is like a psychedelic journey for hours in groups. And in between, for a retreat, we would sit and practice mindful, compassion, loving awareness. And the two of them fit together beautifully, so that when you left the retreat having had these psychedelic type experiences, you could carry that sense of wonder and openness that you're talking about, Louis, as part of your practice, and know how to do it, to quiet your mind, to open your heart, to say, this day, yes, I have to go to work or whatever, let me see the luminosity in it, let me see the beauty and not pass it by.
I love it. You know, the combination of art and science is something that we actually recently did at the Pacific Neuroscience Institute here in Santa Monica. So we did, there was a clinical trial to treat people with alcohol addiction. And what we did was they watched my video of Rhythms and Patterns of Nature on a giant 80-inch 4K TV as they were coming on to psilocybin. And then they did the traditional therapeutic practice of laying down with the therapist with eye shades and headphones. And then I had a short video to help them become grounded at the end, you know, earth tones and shafts of light and canyons, things like that. And so the results showed, which got published in Frontiers of Psychiatry, and this is the first study that's ever been done like this, it showed that the combination of my nature imagery with psilocybin was more effective than the psilocybin by itself. And there had been previous studies where psilocybin had been used at Johns Hopkins and NYU, guys like Steve Ross and Roland Griffiths and Charlie Grobe here at UCLA, you know, showing how psychedelics can be a powerful therapeutic tool for, you know, addiction and PTSD. But to see that the combination was better than psilocybin by itself, and that obviously goes to this awareness we well know about set and setting. It's not just about taking this thing, it's about the intention of what you want to hopefully explore and the environment that you're in. And if you can't be outside in nature, the ability to watch my imagery, which isn't just nature, it's nature that bends time and scale, which is what psychedelics do. So I think it kind of facilitates you on that journey of feeling the connectedness. And for me, the ultimate benefit, when you saw, like in Fantastic Fungi, the patients at Johns Hopkins who were suffering from, you know, a severe, you know, diagnosis of cancer and looking at possible end of life, what was their takeaway? Their takeaway was they lost their fear of dying because they felt connected with everything. And what an incredible gift to be able to give someone who is faced with that dilemma. A, I might be dying. Physiologically, things are going wrong. But mentally, what the fuck? What's going to happen? Where am I going? Especially if they've never had a spiritual experience. Especially if they're maybe stuck in the old paradigm of some religion of heaven and hell. What a frightening cliff to be standing on at that moment. And so the benefit of losing your fear of dying, I believe, helps you heal. Mind and body is connected. You can't separate the two. We know that. So if you can ease the anxiety, those patients that I filmed are still alive.
Yeah. And what you're talking about is also reclaiming the human heritage of the wisdom of these substances as well as the inner trainings, because they're all originally part of the indigenous world, exactly. Whether it's the ayahuasqueros or ibogaine, or, you know, I used to sit with Don Jose Matsuo, Don Jose Rios, this 103-year-old Huichol shaman in peyote ceremonies. And we would sit up all night and chant and take peyote. And it wasn't the peyote alone, although that was powerful, but it was also sitting in community in the middle of the redwoods by a waterfall. And all of a sudden we realized, you know, that we are part of this natural world in a way that you don't. I mean, I grew up in the suburbs, and that wasn't part of the curriculum.
Right.
There's something we're reclaiming our humanity and reclaiming the sacred by doing this. Also, it's incredibly important that we have community, which is why perhaps these groups at Banyan will be really good, because in ways you need to talk about it. I had this amazing experience, or I had this terrifying experience. But if you have the maps, it turns out that when you have a difficult experience, there are ways, as in meditation, to become the loving witness of it, the loving awareness, and say, oh, birth and death, joy and sorrow, good and evil, pleasure and pain, night and day, the opposites create the world. And I can step back and see the dance of it. That it can't just be one-sided, it's only going to be birth. It has to be renewing itself. And that understanding translates into how we hold the unbearable suffering and the unbearable beauty of life, the whole thing. How do we hold that, which is what we are, from a vision of what makes it holy? And that's the freedom that comes. So there's this profound coming together of the perspectives that dates back thousands of years in the Buddhist tradition and tens of thousands of years in the indigenous tradition. Right. And they all invite us into this. And then people will ask, I'm going to say one more thing, but doesn't Buddhism have like precepts? You shouldn't take drugs. You shouldn't get intoxicated. And it does. I mean, in some traditions, in the Hindu Vedic tradition, there was soma. It probably was mushrooms, but it could have been something else. You know, in traditions around the world, there's the use of sacred substances. But the real translation of that Buddhist precept is to not take substances that lead you to intoxication in an unhealthy or unskillful way. So you're not getting drunk and thereafter doing all kinds of other things that harm you and harm other people. This is the opposite.
Yeah.
Yes, everything can be, even psychedelics can be misused. Everything can be misused. But this is the invitation to take this in service of awakening and then to integrate it from your meditation practice into your life.
So I also was born in Brooklyn. And my parents never took me out into nature. My first nature experiences was, as I described, was when I first, you know, went into nature in college. I never knew how to backpack. It's a miracle I survived. I just went out and did it. But I think that what's beautiful, and actually I learned this, gosh, in 1992, I think I did the first really documentary about climate. It was called Oceans of Air. And I told the story through indigenous culture, the Native American, you know, living in the Pacific Northwest. I used their mythology to explain how this landscape evolved. And so what I did learn was their name for their spirit or their god was called Kwati. And Kwati translates into the changer. What a beautiful, beautiful way of looking at, you know, the ultimate spiritual being as the changer. And I think that revelation that I discovered were that, you know, life is change, you know, and everything is always changing and morphing into each other and metamorphosizing fantastic, fungi. It's all about the mycelium and the fungi. I mean, is it the end of life or the beginning of life? You know, because things are broken down into their individual components, which is what fungi do. For life to regenerate, people always look at it as decomposition, as a negative thing, as a bad thing, but maybe it's not. It's simply just recycling energy for the circle to be complete. And once you see it that way, and talking about not getting addicted to things, you don't have to do psychedelics more than once, perhaps, in your life. Once you get it, was it Alan Watts who said, once you get it, hang up? It's like the question now is, how are you going to integrate that wisdom that you got, that gift of wisdom, of nature's intelligence, into your personal relationships, into your community, into, the world? How are you going to activate the wisdom of seeing the harmony, how everything is interconnected, and how, when it is all interconnected, it encourages life to flourish? What a beautiful thing. That's why I think I could have been a biologist as much as I could have become a filmmaker, because I look at those rhythms and patterns of biology and see it as the blueprint for how to live your life. It's a spiritual practice to be able to observe biology, because it evolved over billions of years. And it's all about, communities flourish when everybody works together. There's no greed. Nobody hoards. It's all about regeneration, reconnection, symbiosis, mutualism. These are the things we need right now in our society, right? With the polarization that's happening. It's the feminine side of nature that we need to applaud, not the macho side of kill or be killed, which is in nature documentaries, which I don't like. Survival of the fittest, the top of the food chain. Billions of interactions are happening every second right now in the microbial level, but between pollinators and flowers. Billions of interactions are happening right now that we don't acknowledge on Discovery Channel when it's Shark Week, which gets ratings, So we need to honor the other side, the foundation of life.
And there comes through this, I love what you're saying, a kind of absolutely innate compassion and tenderness, because it's us. It's like if you hurt your hand, you don't say, oh, poor hand, maybe I should take care of it.
Right.
It's you. And the whole gift of meditation and sacred attention or loving awareness is to see that it is all you, that it's you, as you're saying that. So on one of our, we had these large retreats, Stan Groff and I and others, with holotropic breathwork, hours of breathing with intense music and hundreds of people in the room. And I invited my twin brother, who is a scientist. He was a kind of pretty respected geneticist and population biologist. And this was, to come. He'd also taken his psychedelics in the day. And we lay down next to each other and we did this deep breathing for a few hours, not talking at all. And we both, the room dissolved and there was the music and everything became energy or light in its different ways. And we both found ourselves in the womb independently, just lying next to each other. We all had sitters who would help us and tend us. And then we each got born again, and we came out of it. We looked at each other and we said, wow, we were back there in that little space together, and here we are. And there was something mysterious about feeling ourselves, what you're talking about, being part of the universe birthing us in all these forms. And it was my brother died a couple of years later of blood cancer. And this was one of the experiences that kind of in our later life got us back to that incredible sense of opening and awakening. And people say, well, are these experiences is enlightenment and meditation, whatever that is, the same as enlightenment? It's the sacred is the sacred.
Yeah.
The beauty is beauty. Consciousness, who we are is consciousness.
Yeah.
And whether it's these substances or walking in the high mountains, and remembering, feeling that mystery that you're part of it, or making love, or taking psychedelics, or sitting with someone when they're dying. And you're in the face of this mystery. When spirit leaves the consciousness leaves the body, silent like a falling star, and you know that it's not the body, that who we are actually is consciousness itself that inhabits this body, and that the earth is conscious, that this is what we are. So all of this comes revealed, and then we get to live, as you say, Louis, with that understanding.
Yeah. Yeah, and we need to try to figure out how to integrate that in every way, you know, and what that means is cherishing life, being respectful for life. You know, I know you're a Buddhist, but you don't want to step on any living creature, but neither do I. You know, if I see a bug on the ground or an ant, I walk around it.
Yes.
I admire it. I worship it. The beauty of its architectural design. It's all sacred. It's very, and once you sort of lean into that direction, how else can you live your life? I mean, there's no difference between being environmentally conscious or socially conscious, you know? It's all one and the same. And that becomes the values we need, I think, to shape our societies, our culture, our civilization. Let's just all get on board with protecting life. Let's all get on board of protecting what we love. It's easy. It's really easy. It's not political. It's an emotional connection to the energy that is sacred. And you can find it everywhere. A blade of grass cracking through the crack in the sidewalk. I used to walk through the alleys in Venice and shoot stuff all the time. And, you know, so even if you're not a filmmaker, to those that are listening, I really encourage everyone to seek out beauty everywhere you go. It can be the light bouncing off a leaf in the tree. It could be the crack in the sidewalk. It could be the graffiti on the wall. Whatever touches the deepest part of your soul, whatever makes that connection, be open to that. And I think a lot of times when people watch my films, and the common reaction is, oh my God. And then what does oh my God mean? Oh means it made you present. Mind means it connects with your soul, and God is that spiritual energy we all want to be connected to. The jaw drops. That's a cool thing. Oh my God. So finally, like you, I caught your attention. We caught your consciousness, get you out of that, you know, rat race thing. And if you can, you know, again, it's just another way of being, having a mindfulness practice, because what does it do? It makes you present. Wow. Look at that. And when people come out of my films many times with tears, and they, and you know, they cry, and I know it's not a sad movie, but it's because I think it touched their soul. So what I'm capturing is universal. I'm just a conduit. It isn't my art. I'm just transferring energy to you, these rhythms and patterns that are universal, right? The rhythms and patterns that are on Mars are the same that are the neural networks in your brain, that are the same in the mitochondria in your cell. And when you see it, you recognize it. And because you recognize it, it's a homecoming. It's a homecoming. And that's why I believe it's also healing. When people have said, they'd look at, you know, the moving art series and everything from children with autism, the teenagers that are suicidal, people with cancer, end of life, all the above, they say it's a healing modality without me ever proclaiming it's a healing modality, because they are looking at a mirror of life going forward, of healing energy. This is the rhythm and metabolism that makes life go forward. Don't we want to be on that train? Don't we want to be on that? Or do you want to be on something that's like dead or negative? So this whole idea of looking at these rhythms and patterns is sacred.
So when you say, so to me, I so touch when you, you know, invite us to look for beauty everywhere. In a way, our meditation practice, because they come together, and you said it so directly, to become mindful. And I like the phrase mindful loving awareness, because it's an awareness that actually pays attention with the heart as woven into it, that we learn the practices and we take the time to quiet the mind,
right,
to open the heart in the simplest way. And that doesn't mean it's all, you know, happy. If you get close enough to nature, as you say, it's being born and it's dying and it's growing and it's decaying. And it has to do that. And there's a wonder in it. I was going to hold up a flower. I had a flower behind me. I will hold it up. But it turns out that the flower has also already started in its decay.
Yeah.
Right? Here's your enlightenment. This is it. It was beautiful in one form. I have a friend who did a book called, it was something like, I forget the title. It was something like Disappearing Beauty. And it was photos of flowers as they were fading. The mindfulness, the practice that we have says, well, look at this wonder. Where did this come from? This is extraordinary. And it is going through the remarkable changes that everything on life, what you're describing. So meditation, like the beauty you just, is the doorway to right. See this with in its glory. Thank you all. Take care.